Blog Talk Radio.
TM Worldwide Radio, and this is Books to Read. It is August the 20th, 2019. The year is just moseying on along, isn't it? 646-652-4479 is the number. The Books to Read show is a show I created a few years ago, actually, interviewing published authors of different genres. I thought it was just something important to not forget the fact that we do still have books out there. There's still shelves with stories that need to be told, and we have people who are bold enough to take the time to put them together. So tonight we have another author, and in this particular case, I have to do this particular intro, and let me go ahead and get over here. So my guest tonight is the very definition of a learned scholar. He has a PhD in English from the University of London. He has been a professor of English at California State University for decades now. He is an accomplished author, obviously, winning several awards, including the James Tate Memorial Award for Best Biography. But also, he is a frequent lecturer as well. And this evening, we are going to get to learn about him, his publications, and much more. So that being said, let's go ahead and bring Mr. Brian Finney onto the show. Good evening, Brian. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Chris. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you. Oh, wow. That applause is
what
really
was that?
Loud. Let's turn that down. Yeah, that was the crowd applauding, but they're a little bit hyped today. First of all, I want to say thanks for being on because, you know, since your book is actually being released on the 22nd, I know you're very busy. So, again, appreciate you being on the show tonight. We're going to be talking about your book, Money Matters, a little bit later in the show. But usually when I have someone new to the show who's never been on the show before, I like to get the audience to get to know who that author is and get to know them a little bit. So first things first, where are you from originally, Brian?
I was born in London, and I spent the first nearly 50 years of my life there.
That's a nice bit of time there.
I'm an immigrant, therefore, as far as the United States is concerned, though I've been here for 30 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
Well, I was going to say, because with that period of time, your London is much different from the London today. So could you tell us a little bit what it was like growing up during your period of time in London?
Well, of course, you know, it was basically a bombed out city when I was a kid to remember it. In fact, I even remember the last year of the war when as a kid I would be woken up in the middle of the night and taken down to what they called an Anderson shelter, which was, you know, a shelter at the end of the garden which was dug out with corrugated iron and sandbags on top of it. And being extremely ill-tempered at being woken up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But learning, you know, I mean, London suffered from what was called the V2 rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you heard it, you're okay. Because when it stopped, when the engine stopped working, there was something like, I can't remember exactly how many seconds, but like you counted to 12 and then it hit the ground and exploded. So that was my first memories of London, really.
Wow, goodness! And I had to ask that because I'm not a historian per se, but I do like history and anything, you know, World War II or anything along those lines. So I had to ask you that because I kind of did the math, and I said, you probably had some taste of it there. So first and foremost, I'm glad you're with us, of course, because that is a moment in history. Of course, we're still, even all these years later, it still affects people.
It's true.
Yeah. So growing up, let me ask you this now, because of course I did your intro, so we all know that you're a very, you know, what's the word I'm looking for here? Let's just use the word scholarly. Were you always an avid student though as a child?
I always enjoyed learning stuff. So I guess you could say yes, but I wasn't exceptional. I wasn't sort of, you know, A1 type of student. And in fact, after I finished my first degree, I couldn't get a scholarship to stay on to do further degrees and left to do national service in the Royal Air Force because I was the very last year when there was compulsory national service in the forces. And so I ended up doing 3 years in the Royal Air Force as an education officer and cipher officer. Then I went into industry, in fact. I certainly wasn't, on a one-track career to academia. I spent 5 years in industry, first of all, as an internal consultant for a huge car electrical firm, Joseph Lucas. And then I transferred and became a production control manager at a factory producing quartz crystals for standard telephones and cables.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask you about what that actually meant. That's very interesting there.
Well, at that time, they have to cut the quartz in a particular angle to get a particular wireless wavelength. And they weren't very accurate at this, and they were chucking all the discards away. So when I came, the first thing I did was to create a huge library and to put the discards into whatever frequency they are, because sure, sooner or later, that frequency was being requested. I quite enjoyed the challenge, but because basically speaking, they were saying we can't produce enough. The sales department was demanding that the production department created more. So I saw my chart go up to like twice the production, at which point the sales department admitted that they'd in fact overestimated the demand, and I was asked to cut back. So I watched this chart going back down again, and I thought, do I really want to spend the rest of my life, doing this? And that's when I got out and moved into the University of London, first of all, as an arts administrator. Which involved, arts administration. It's a little bit like American Extension because it involved hiring university faculty of one sort or another and putting them on mainly in the evening and weekends for the adult London population in various locations throughout London. But it included, putting on lectures at the National Gallery and the Institute of Contemporary Arts and so on as well. We worked with the National Film Institute, the whole way, all the way across the arts. I was hiring and organizing classes. But I was teaching English one class a week only. And eventually I decided, okay, I better get a PhD. So I registered for a PhD with London University and decided that I was going to do D.H. Lawrence's short stories because I thought he was better as a short story writer than he was as a novelist. And sure enough, nobody had done any work on it at all. And nearly all the manuscripts were in the United States, which is what brought me over to the States in the first place in 1970-1971. I would go to, should we say, Yale, a special collections library there, and I would find the original handwritten copy of a story that the publisher had lost the second half of and had written to Lawrence when he was in Italy and said, please rewrite the second half of the story because I can't find it. And, you know, by that time, Lawrence was in a totally different state of mind. So the story is broken back as it was published in everywhere, including Penguins, at that time. Mm-hmm. So I was able to write to them and say, look, you know, I found the original one, and you know, it's much better than the one you're publishing at the moment. So that was a fun project. I mean, it wasn't just a boring PhD. It was sort of actually making a difference to, you know, what was known of Lawrence and what was published by him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was one other occasion might amuse you, when I went to New York Public Library, and mm-hmm. I was comparing the exercise book in which he'd written the story. It was actually a novella-length story with the original. And sure enough, I mean, suddenly the printer had skipped a double page. And it just so happened that, you know, speaker A finished at the bottom of one page, and three, you know, the double page later, speaker B happened to be responding to a quite different question, but it sort of made sense. And enough not to anybody say, my God, you know, there must be something missing here.
Yeah.
So I was able to get them to restore that too.
Wow. These transitions that you've had, and actually you're kind of making my job a little bit easy, in regards to where you mentioned, you know, your time in the Royal Air Force to the time where you were at Joseph Lucas, and then the reason that you ended up coming to America from London are pretty special, just because of just the span of your life up until that time. Let me ask you this, because now let's get to where you're in America now, and you're just kind of starting out. As far as being a professor, when did that come about? Like, how did you end up becoming a professor at California University?
Well, I gradually in London, I had converted slowly from being mainly administrative and organizing to mainly teaching, and eventually I became a full-time lecturer there, and I applied for an American position, and it wasn't successful. So I thought, oh, to hell with it, I'm fed up with this job here, because I was also the equivalent of chair of a department that was executing Maggie Thatcher's savage cuts to adult education at the time. I don't want to be doing this. I don't agree with the policy, and why am I spending my time doing this? So I thought, to hell with it, I'm going to go. By then I'd also met my American wife, and I arranged everything. And the very day before I left, when I was standing in my apartment with everything packed up and just the telephone still working, the phone went.
Mm-hmm.
And the chair of University of California, Riverside, rang up and said, you know that job you applied for? Well, the person, our first choice, got caught in a contract with another university, and so you now are our first choice. So if you want the job, you've got it, and it starts a month prior to now. I really had a soft landing. For 2 years, I had a visiting professorship there. But after that, I got thrown onto the job market as a freelancer. And for a long time, I was going to more than one university, like, you know, UCLA and University of Southern California, and then California State University, Long Beach. And I chose California State University, Long Beach, because the class size was infinitely smaller. It was like 30 max. Whereas, you know, in UCLA, I would be talking to over 100 students, and then graduates would take them to the interesting bit, which was the seminars where they actually discuss stuff. And I don't like really just standing up there and performing. It's not my, you know, not what I want to be doing. Mm. So eventually, you know, I settled on California State University. And finally, I must have been one of the oldest people to get tenure in the United States. And I sort of rushed my way through the, you know, the promotion system to get to full professor in like 5 years or something. So that's how it happened. But what I didn't tell you was that what brought me over to Southern California was the research for the book on Christopher Isherwood that I was doing at the time. And, you know, it was while I was doing that research that I met the woman who was going to become my American wife. So, you know, that settled it then. Then I sort of seriously got down to paperwork and visas and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the book that, so to speak, you know, cast the die in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad it worked out for you.
Yeah, I sure did.
Brian, 646-652-4479 is the number if anybody wants to call in and ask Mr. Finney a question. Now, let me ask you this. So being a professor, and you're there at the university, teaching. So obviously, first of all, you're a professor of English. So is there a particular aspect of it that you enjoy more than another? Is it just a matter of you just generally enjoy teaching, or maybe you don't enjoy teaching as much? I don't know. But give us a little bit of a glimpse as far as that goes, because there's some people just see, okay, you're a professor and you're going to do this and that, and we're going to go in the class, we're going to go out. You've already kind of mentioned that you kind of prefer the smaller class size rather than 100 people being in there. So what is it about teaching that you enjoy the most? And as far as you being an English professor, what do you enjoy as far as that aspect as well?
Well, I think I really enjoy interacting with students. I don't like just, you know, I don't think that I know anything more than students do, except for the amount of reading I've done. And that's not going to help them, you know, if I just tell them about stuff they haven't read. So what actually teaching a student, shall we say, novels, which was the thing I most did, involves making them think harder, involves making them reason why, you know, they can't just come out with an opinion and say, oh, this is a great book and this is really cool, man. You know, I know, okay, what do you mean by cool? And, you know, why is it cool? So you actually force them to develop their minds in a way that will also help them, you know, when they come to, shall we say, you know, vote, or when they come to make any kind of civic or social or communal action of any kind. So, you know, I really enjoyed that, because I feel that that's what makes a democracy, really, is an educated citizenship. I enjoyed it right all the time. I've never not liked teaching, although now I'm a professor emeritus and only teach very rarely. I'm happy to say, because that gave me the time to write my latest book.
There you go. So that's a perfect segue there, Brian. Appreciate that. So before we start talking about money matters specifically, writing-wise, now, when did, as far as you teaching and everything and being a professor, when did writing actually start for you as far as genre at the time? And what did you write about? How frequent did you write? Did you feel successful at first? Were there some aches and pains per se? Give us a little bit of your history as far as a writer.
Well, I started off writing about literature. And in fact, I started off writing a friend of mine who was editing a series of small books for Covent Garden Press asked me whether I would write something on Beckett's most recent fiction, which was very short and enigmatic and difficult, you know, to for people to deal with. And so after that was in itself quite fascinating, because I corresponded with Beckett, and eventually I met him and spent an hour in a cafe in Paris with him. So that had a reward. Although I must say that for the first 15 minutes, I'm not easily scared, but he had a kind of gaze that looked into the back of your head rather than into the front of it. And I hardly said a word, until I found my normal self back again, which hasn't happened to me very often at all. But then after that, I decided that I wanted to write about Christopher Isherwood, who I thought was a very influential writer, which he was, and who had not been written about. And so I decided to do a critical biography being, you know, part life and part analysis of the works as you go through the life. Mm-hmm. And that in itself took me out to Southern California, because by then Isherwood was living in Santa Monica, in Santa Monica Canyon, which is very near here where I live now. One interesting story I have from that time of research was that, you know, I was interviewing all his friends and acquaintances, and although Aldous Huxley, who had been a good friend, was no longer alive, Laura Huxley's wife still was. And she was, you know, reputed to be somewhat of a mystic. Mm-hmm. So I went and interviewed her for, an hour or two in this house up in the Hollywood Hills, looking over at Los Angeles. And when I was taking my leave from her, she looked at me and she said to me, you know, you're going to be coming back here. So I, I'm a bit of a skeptic. And I said, oh, yeah, really? You know, so, no, she said, seriously, you are going to come back here in a permanent kind of way. So I dismissed it at the time. And then, I don't know, maybe what would it be? Well over 10 years later, I land up by immigrating.
Oh, wow. I guess you're right.
Yes, so that sort of undercut my normal skepticism about, you know, the spiritualist side of things.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, okay, so the biography was really interesting because it involves accumulating a huge amount of facts. Luckily, nobody had done it, so, you know, I was the first on the field, and I got an awful lot of people's letters and interviews and so on. And you then have to master those facts, if you like. In other words, you have to be able to turn them into a story that people want to read. And so you have to learn to ignore things, however interesting in themselves they might be, if they don't actually contribute to the ongoing storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of set the scene for me as far as writing was concerned, because thereafter, all my writing involved a lot of research, but ultimately it was making the book readable, giving it, a plot line, so to speak, a shape, a form, that, you know, dictated how I wrote it. So after that, I went on to write. I wrote, actually, something about literary autobiography as a genre, which was greeted in England as a new, how shall I say, an innovative look at that whole genre. And then I wrote about individual writers, and I wrote a whole book about Martin Amis, who I thought was very innovative in the 80s. Mm-hmm. He wrote that great book, Money, about Thatcher's England and Reagan's America. And the book alternates in chapters between London and New York. And it's a wonderful skit on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one book, the last book I wrote before this one, this novel, was completely outside my field. It was called Terrorized, How the War on Terror Affected American Culture and Society. And I think I'd been here by then long enough. I'd been here over 20 years by 9/11 to feel confident enough to say, look, you know, things have changed utterly, that they're never going to go back. I was writing I finished writing it during the beginning of the Obama presidency. Mm-hmm. And it was really a kind of socio-economic study. And it involved a lot of different kinds of research to the ones I was used to, with different sources and different ways of finding them and so on. But again, I really enjoyed doing it, and each chapter tells, you know, its own story about, shall we say, torture, or, you know, about revenge, you know, the various things that sort of consumed America after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So you went basically on a different tangent as far as, like, you know, you actually used a good terminology, out of your comfort zone for that particular book, Terrorize. Money Matters is even more outside, because this is your first actual novel. So what made you consider doing this as far as a genre? And, of course, go ahead and tell us a little, don't give us too much now, Brian, but go ahead and tell us a little bit about the book and why you feel people would enjoy reading it.
Well, for a start, I'd always wanted to write fiction, but I couldn't do that as part of my professional job. And mm-hmm. As you know, there's enormous pressure on particularly university faculty to publish or perish, to actually, if you want to get promoted up through the ladder and so on, then you have to publish books within the field. So mm-hmm. as soon as I stopped full-time teaching, I turned to what I'd always wanted to do, which was to write a novel. Why it took this particular shape, I've spent the rest of my time asking myself. But I think one answer is that the book is about a young American woman living in Venice, where I live, in Los Angeles, who is asked by the housekeeper of a household that she works for and that also Jenny, my protagonist, works for, to find out what happened to the CEO's girlfriend who disappeared 3 months previous to the beginning of the book and who she was very close to, the housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And so what it is, it therefore resolved itself on the one hand into an amateur sleuth story, but on the other hand, as far as I'm concerned, it involved not just the housekeeper, but her nephew who is undocumented, and she becomes strongly attracted to the director of an immigrant rights organization. So it involved, it had a lot to do with immigration and the current state of immigration in mm-hmm. And this is the other thing, in 2010, because the whole book is centered around the 6 days surrounding the midterm election of 2010. And in fact, the brother of the CEO who she works part-time for is running for governor instead of Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman being the Republican nominee and Brown, who won the election, being Brown. In the book. So, it involves some actual historical figures, not many, a few, one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues it raises, of course, have only become more acute today, if anything. That we're obviously immigration, which was, a hot issue even in Obama's first presidency, has become an enormously controversial topic today. So, if anything, although you can barely call the novel historical, but although it's set 9 years earlier, it reads as if it's contemporary at the same time, simultaneously. And the other issue from which the title comes, Money Matters, concerns the disparity in wealth that somehow not, it isn't just a result of, policy by politicians. It's also a result of, if you like, the logic of capitalism, that is actually creating inevitably a bigger and bigger disparity between rich and poor.
In one of the promos I saw, I see it says she's poor and naive, they're rich and dangerous. So exactly.
And she lands up trying to find this disappeared girlfriend. She ends up facing, the sort of combined powers of the brother, Republican running for office, the CEO, who is the CEO of the second largest mutual fund company in America, and it turns out the Baja Cartel, who are investing in one of the mutual funds, private funds, which is basically trading on, that huge housing crisis where the banks were forced to sell their mortgages at a loss. And one or two of the mutual fund companies were making enormous amounts of money out of the buying what the banks didn't want to sell but were forced to sell. And meantime, Jenny, hasn't got a life together. She lives in her sister's apartment. She has two part-time jobs, one, as I say, with the CEO of the mutual company, one with a large Los Angeles Detective Agency, for which she doesn't do detection work. She does. She basically she looks through videos, surveillance videos, and marks the relevant parts of them. So it's an incredibly, what shall I say, menial kind of job.
Sounds pretty. I'll throw it out there. Yeah.
So you know, she. I mean, and at the same time. She has a sister whose apartment she lives in, who's a tremendously successful realtor, and who earns a fortune. In fact, you know, one good deal, one good sale, as Jenny reflects, amounts to her year's salary. And at the same time, she's not she just distrusts money as an end in itself, and she feels that. You know, everybody around her is too busy chasing money without knowing what they want to do with it when they have it. So she's caught between wanting more money than she has, but wanting to have some kind of job that gives satisfaction in that you feel you're giving back to the community as well in the course of doing it.
So with all these variances, and you got some twists, some turns, and a little historical in there, but it's a fiction novel. I've asked past authors that do fiction this particular question. And again, the book is just coming out. But do you feel, just from how you wrote it, could this be a book that could be translated into television or film? And would you want it to if it could?
I think it would make a good indie film. You know, okay. I mean, I don't think it's a blockbuster. It's not going to be in the, you know, 100 million kind of budget thing. Mm-hmm. But it would make a great independent, you know, movie producer film. And I would love to see it actually done because I think it's short. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, it lends itself to being turned into a film, because if you have too big a book, you have to cut too much out of
yeah,
the book in order to
it
make
hard,
it work
yeah.
as a film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's topical. You know, the biggest difficulty I had with it was that, you know, my heroine Jenny, who narrates the book as well, in mm-hmm. the present tense, is, you know, she's young, she's female, and she's American, and I'm, shall we say, older at least, and I'm a male, and I still, as you can hear, you know, speak with a British accent, and I use some British vocabulary as well. And I had, although it was very easy, I found her voice very quickly, and that made mm-hmm. writing the book very easy for me. It sort of came readily. Nevertheless, mm-hmm. I had maybe 5 or 6 different people, including, you know, editors and my wife and friends, read through it in order to get rid of every single English expression or, you know, word or what have you.
Mm.
it now is very authentic, I think, as far as I can make out.
I bet that was a little bit of a hurdle there, but it sounds
well,
like you had a lot of help.
But you don't hear your own mistakes. You know, I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
because we use the same language, we don't realize that, you know, I mean, that I say Renaissance and Americans say Renaissance, you know, that
Renaissance,
kind of thing,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it goes
very
on
small.
And on. There's a very large dictionary of English-American English.
We will always be tied at the hip, huh, Brian? One way or the other. Oh, wow. Well, first of all, again, I just want to say thank you for being able to take time out of your busy schedule. I'm really happy about your book coming out on Thursday. A couple of things, though. What is next for you, Brian? Do you have another novel in the back pocket there? Are you going to be doing anything that's nonfiction again? What are some things that you have planned?
You know, I mean, I'm still trying to decide, and I have a number of different alternatives available. One would be some kind of, you know, this novel ends on a relatively optimistic note, and
okay.
You know, living in this age that we live in, I think that optimistic note needs undercutting sooner or later. So a continuation of it would definitely involve some reality breaking in on that. Alternatively, as you heard when I was talking about it, I mean, I had a somewhat unusual childhood, and it would be interesting to write a memoir that's not about me so much as about a fictional me, you know, as representative of a generation, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That's an alternative. And then, you know, as you say, there's also always the possibility of writing a totally non-fiction work. But I'm waiting. It, as you know, launching a book properly is enormously, you know, it involves a lot of work. So I haven't really given myself the time to work out exactly what I'm going to go on next to do.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll definitely be looking forward to whatever you come up with. I definitely will push on the end of, again, maybe not you personally, but a fictional you. I think that, that time period would be, and you experiencing it, I definitely would, I would say throw that out there as a definite one you should think about too.
Well, thank you.
Oh, no problem. Money Matters. How can people get it? How is it coming out? Do you have a website, social media? Go ahead and let us know that.
Okay. So first of all, I do have a website, which is bhfinney.com. And it's coming out as both a paperback, an ebook, and an audiobook. And in the audiobook, I've got I have a wonderful female narrator who does an excellent job on that. And it's coming out initially speaking on Amazon, and you know you've only got to go to the website, my website, and you can be, you're led there to where it is on sale. So, you know, for the moment, that's where it stands. So who knows what will happen once it actually appears in public.
Well, hey, bestseller. You never know. So you got to say it. You got to say it right now, Brian. It's going to be a bestseller. You got to go all the way right now. Well, again, I want to say congratulations again.
Thank you.
Again, anytime you have a release, it's always – it's a little nerve-wracking, like you said. It's definitely
– And exciting at the same time.
And exciting at the same time. And then it's just a matter of going through it and then you having your first signing and things of that nature. And since you have the experience as far as being a lecturer, I know you'll have a great time being able to speak on the book in public settings that might be coming up as well. So one more time, Brian, I want to say thank you so much for being on the show. And definitely, next time you have a book that comes out, I would love to have you on the show again soon.
I will, and thank you very much for having me.
No problem,
Brian.
You take care, and you have a great rest of the week, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. That was Brian. Let's try this again. Brian H. Finney. There we go. I told the audience to calm down a little bit. I don't know what happened at the beginning of the show, but he understood. I appreciate that. So as we close out Books to Read tonight, and I want to say thanks for those who did watch and listen on the Writers Group page on Facebook. That I actually did my Facebook Live tonight. Hopefully y'all enjoyed Mr. Finney's retelling of his history. You know, he's done a lot. And let's see, I got to type this in real quick, folks. He's done a lot with his years of experience, and it was just really enjoyable just kind of listening to someone who's been through so much on a historical tangent in two different countries at that. So anything that he does put pen to paper on, you can pretty much trust, you know, the authenticity part of it. And it's different. Like I said, I'm not in the story yet, but I like historical stuff. So anything, so I had to ask him about his London compared to now, because again, I did the math and I kind of had a feeling he had some experience with, you know, those rockets coming from Germany and just blowing up stuff. And it's, I remember all the movies of, you know, the bunkers and things of that nature and having to turn the lights off because the air raid sirens going off and things of that nature. He lived that. You see what I'm saying? And so that was very cool for him to be able to recount that. That's as far as growing up, working, being in the Royal Air Force, and then electrical on the engineering side of things, and then moving to America, becoming a professor, and here he is now with all these different experiences, and he gets to write about them. So hopefully everybody enjoyed that with Mr. Finney. And again, make sure you go to his website. I'm actually posted it on the Facebook page, bhfinney.com, and all of his social media is there as well. The name of the book is Money Matters. It comes out on Thursday, so you gotta make sure you grab a copy, y'all. Don't mess up and listen to this whole interview and then don't participate. Come on, make sure that happens now. So Books to Read, again, is a show that I created to specifically talk about authors, published authors in different genres. It's important to know that, again, with all the technology that we have out there, that reading a book doesn't kill you still, right? And there's possibilities to do well as an author, believe it or not. Now, yes, it's time consuming between the research and like he was mentioning, with editors and things of that nature. You got to do the artwork and just all that kind of stuff. But you heard him. He has an audio book, an e-book, paperback. There's the different levels of getting it done, and you just have to be able to have the wherewithal to have the patience to do it, and, of course, the ability to write something that people will eventually read. And you heard him. Hey, he might have a movie coming out. You never know. An independent film called Money Matters. So that was very interesting as well. So as we bid y'all adieu for tonight, make sure you're listening on blogtalkradio.com/IMTN Worldwide. Follow that page. That's a live show every week. Well, not every week, but every week we have a show that comes on. But listen, but make sure you follow that page. iHeartRadio, definitely follow that particular page for Books to Read, or IMTN Worldwide Radio. iHeartRadio now publishes all of my shows that comes on IMTN Worldwide Radio. I'm very excited about that. You can also follow on Facebook and Instagram under IMTN Worldwide Radio. You can like the Facebook page. You can follow the Instagram page. I appreciate that. If you have the Spreaker app, you can download that and to your phone and follow the IMTN Worldwide Radio page. That way you can click on the particular show that you want to listen to. You can listen to it. You can pause. You can fast forward. You can reverse at the convenience of your cell phone. Definitely appreciate all that. You know, listen on the different platforms, Spotify, iTunes, of course, Buzzsprout, Google Play, all those different formats. We appreciate you. Of course, there's my other show, Around the ATL, which airs every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Shameless plug, because the show is tomorrow. So make sure you listen to that if you love Atlanta, Georgia sports. We appreciate that. So we hope to have another Around Books to Read show coming up soon. Of course, there's a lot of authors I've never heard of before still, and I hope to get to talk to all of them as the year progresses. So that being said, we're going to get out of here. Again, appreciate all the audience from the Writers Group Facebook page, listening in, watching, those who are listening who are just regular fans of the show who decided to listen to this particular show. I appreciate y'all. And those who are going to listen to the podcast form later, please share. Please follow the pages. It helps me out so much if you follow and share as much as you can. I really do appreciate it. So that being said, we're going to go ahead and get out of here. This was Books to Read on IMTN Worldwide Radio. Thanks again for Mr. Brian H. Finney for joining the show. His book is called Money Matters. It comes out this Thursday. Make sure you go to his website and pick up a copy. Till next time, y'all take care. Peace. Thank you.